But it was that mentality of, yeah, you've got a decent job, just stick with it. And then you stick with it, you're miserable, you retire, you're a bit less miserable, and then you die. So, chaps, it's brilliant to have you along. Been looking forward to speaking to you both. What we're going to get into is your backstory and a bit about you. You're both professional coaches working with clients, in particular men, around relationships. But before we get into that, what I want to do is ask you the question we're going to ask everybody, really, is what does confidence mean to you? And kind of how has that shaped the work you do and who you are?
I've been able to think about it since you asked that question. I think for me, I was trying to, I was going backwards and forwards on what's confidence and what's courage, because that was the question that I was going backwards and forwards on in my mind. And I think for me, I landed on confidence. To me, is knowing I can go into a situation or do a certain thing, and there being a fairly high probability I can do it without any question at all. So, like, if somebody said, "Hey, can you ride a bike?" I wouldn't think twice about that answer. Of course, I can. Do you know what I mean? That to me is what feels like confidence. But then I was also juggling that a bit on the way here, thinking, well, but there's degrees of it as well, you know. But to feel confident, I've got to be kind of, I was thinking maybe like 75% plus sure I can do something. Then I feel confident. Outside of that, it feels like courage to me.
Interesting. So, just ask a question on that, and we'll get Phil's kind of thought. What courage then? What it's when you have less, a lower level of confidence, but you do it anyway. Is that what
Courage to me is not being sure that I can do something, but having the courage to do it
right?
anyway.
So the courage to build up that confidence to get to that 75%, where you're thinking, "I'm going into something here, and I can
It's like, yeah, I'm
definitely do
going
that.
down.
I've got this."
Like
I like it.
Interesting. What about you, Phil?
So kind of related to that, what I would say is courage for me would be doing the thing. Confidence is what I would say comes after. I would say confidence is the result. So if you are, for in that example, learning to ride a bike, the courage is kind of getting on there and falling off, and then next time knowing, all right, okay, if I do that, then I'm going to fall off, so I'll try something else. I'll try and find the balance, and then the confidence is kind of built up through that. And that's what I would say. I think for me, confidence is a result of doing the thing, which you would say is courage. So I absolutely do link the two. But like, I used to work with this paramilitary parachute man. I can't remember his actual title, but he high parachute, but that's the one. Talking to the jump out of airplanes and parachutes, and I was chatting to him about confidence. I worked as a confidence coach at the time, and he said, "No one's ever confident, no matter how many jumps you've done, going up." He said, "You've got to kind of jump out, and once your parachute opens, you can start feeling a bit confident." But he said, "The people who overthink that and feel like you should be confident before it, like even like before an exam, like you think, 'Oh man, I don't feel like fully. Like I'm going to nail it.' You just got to kind of go and do it and feel confident after, if that makes sense."
Wow,
So
that's
there's a theme here with experience, confidence. Are we born with confidence? It's I think it comes with experience, life experience, doing something many times, learning.
And I think there's something. There's like I think there's also this other element of it, which I don't know if I fully fleshed this out yet, but I used to think I was really confident. So I was always the kid that would stand up and speak or make jokes or get on stage and play in a band or do stand-up comedy or something like that. So yeah, I'm a confident guy. But really, I kind of had that niggling feeling of I'm not actually confident in myself, I'm not confident in who I am as a person. But then I would think, well, I get out there and I'm loud and I'm in front of everyone, so I must be confident. And I think that's not it, I suppose. Now I'm much calmer, and there's a quiet maybe acceptance of who I am. I don't know if that plays into it as well. I like the idea that I've heard somewhere else which said that, you know, confidence is like having an irrefutable mountain of proof that you can do something. And I always like that. It's like, yeah, no way can you deny that I'm capable of doing that particular thing or activity or skill or.
I think it's a big thing with mindset as well. I suppose if you if your mind's telling you that you can't do something or that's impossible to do, you know, straight away that's a big barrier up to overcoming that.
Yeah, massively, because you're coming from that place, aren't you? You're coming from that place where that's how the world looks. And so you make decisions, you say things based off that. You're like, you're going to react to the notion that this isn't going to work. So that's completely different. You take completely different action and say completely different things. It's to someone who is, that is going to work, has that irrefutable.
That's interesting, because there's a couple of things there, like teasing out. One, there's, you talked about, you know, be appearing confident versus am I really? And then that shift in yourself where you feel an inner sense of confidence. But there's also the time where potentially you can be overconfident. And is that kind of what the paratroop was sort of hinting at, that you can sometimes, if you don't have that level of doubt, it maybe means you don't prepare enough, or you know, you don't check in? Because to me, that sounds like a lot of courage to step out of that airplane without being fully confident.
Well, I guess to me that would be like more in what Rich was saying, in the, you can prepare to give yourself a little bit more courage. You can certainly prepare yourself for things to go as well as possible, but I don't know if that would be out of confidence. I do think confidence is the thing that kind of comes after.
I've jumped out of a plane before and I did not feel confident.
I'm scared of heights, so I'm not jumping out of a plane.
No, me neither.
I was told I was too big to jump out of a plane.
What?
There you go.
Is that actually a thing?
Apparently so.
No offense, mate, but weight-wise or
just general-wise, I think.
Because I'm not sure if there is some sort of restriction on parachutes and stuff like that, that they can only handle a certain weight or...
Surely not the size of those things.
I don't know. It's funny, wasn't it? But
I didn't look into it. That's just... all right. That's a life experience I'm probably not going to have.
Is there any big moments that you've really doubted yourself for something and not felt confident at all? And if there has been... how have you overcome them?
All exams, I would say. I've never gone into an exam confident, and I've done all right for the most part. some of them not so much. There's been things like running the first like coaching group or talking in front of people. Weirdly with me, it's if I say took something like my music, I would much rather play in front of a large group of people than a really small group of people. So it's the same with the kind of coaching thing. If there's lots of people there, I'm all right. Well, I'm all right in general now, but I've always been all right. But if there's a small number of people, like if someone's like, get your guitar out and play now, I'd be like, that's the worst thing I can possibly imagine. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's the focus being on me kind of thing, but it's always been a bit of a difficult one for me to get through. How do I overcome it? I just jump out of the plane. I just do it. I wish there was something more like a more profound, but I do think there has to be that big part of it, which is just doing the thing.
Jump right in.
Confidence shows up afterwards.
They're just seeing it as, right, I'll do it, and then I can start working on confidence after I learn to fall off the bike so that I can learn the balance kind of thing.
That's a good question. I was just trying to think, was there anything I didn't feel confident? I think that there's a lot of the time there can be doubts there, but when I get down to it, if I can get myself back to a place of, well, is this physically possible for you to do this? The answer is usually always yes.
Right, yeah.
So, I think it's often around things like, I tell you one that comes to mind recently where I felt really quite uncomfortable was the first time I'm part of a business club, and the first time I went to a formal meeting and I was a new member. They were like, oh, come up on the stage and talk about what you're doing. I was like, oh my God. And it was a room full of like 130 odd people or something like that. I definitely felt shaken at that moment. And part of it, I think in hindsight now, was if I'd prepared myself better for that moment, it would have gone better. But I kind of went up and just felt like I kind of bumbled something out in order to say something. But then afterwards I thought, yeah, you did it though, you know. You stood up there and talked about what you do, and you know, you weren't maybe the best prepared you could have been, but you did it. That's the important thing. And there were some people who chose not to,
right.
And that was an option not to as well. We were told you don't have to come and talk about your business on stage. And I thought, I'd be daft not to though, wouldn't I? Like, so,
especially when you've got 130 people there.
Yeah.
I know it's a similar thing, actually. I did my first ever speaking event at York Fashion Week this year. And it was just talking about, you know, the business, my background. And it's one of the hardest things, I think, sometimes talking about yourself. But I did prep. I did a lot of prep for it. There was about 20 people there. And I used to work in sales. Mm. And I used to go into sales pitches. Not a problem at all, but I was prepped. But the one big thing, and I think this is the advice that's probably similar from all of us. I remember being at university. I did an engineering degree. And I went into my first presentation. It was for a project and I did not prepare at all. Mm. And I had to stand up in front of the rest of my class and it was just embarrassing. And I thought from that day, there is no way I'm going into anything when I haven't prepped.
Yeah.
And preparation, it's just the courage. Mm-hmm. So that preparation to do it the first time and then the second time going, right, okay,
yeah.
I've had the courage, yeah. I've prepped and now I feel really confident. And yeah. I think that goes with everything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that really helped me with that this whole side of things was learning the distinction of messy versus right. Because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people really look at a situation like a speaking thing or something like that, and they're like, right, it's got to go this way. It's got to be exactly right. It's got to go spot on. But if you can kind of look at it more like, okay, it's just doing it, get messy. Yeah, yeah. It's going to go wrong. Yeah, I'm going to fall off. Yeah, I'm going to do this. Mm. I might say the wrong word here, but I can kind of learn for next time and you can learn from the event. Then you can build and build and build. Whereas if you're waiting for the right circumstance, the right crowd, the right feeling, the right words to say, it, like you say, more often than not, people freeze, they don't jump out the plane, they don't get on stage and talk because things need to be just right. Kind of embrace that. Things can get messy, and doing it is the kind of key to that, I would say.
Well, you know the background I came from, and you know, doing what I did prior in my life as a GP was not about me being the centre of attention. It was always about me being in service of somebody else. And then to go into a thing where it's like I am it, I am the product, I am the centre of attention was like a really uncomfortable shift to learn to make, and. So it was a big stretch to get up on that stage, but at the same time, like Phil says, it was a question of like, oh, right, okay, so this is what happens in a business meeting when people give a pitch, because I don't know, I've never been in that room before, yeah. You know? So I was like, okay, I know for next time, like, right? this is where I need to be in order to walk into that room more confidently.
I think you've got to make mistakes as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think people can be too worried about making mistakes, and it's the only way you learn. And then sometimes as well, you know, people hold back and they don't do anything. They talk about things, but then they don't do it. And yet for me, if you just like it doesn't matter whether it's in business or your personal life, you've got to make them mistakes and learn from them and move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. When I did my coaching training originally with the Jay Shetty school thing, I can't remember the exact number, but there's only two of us that are still coaching. And the thing that we did that the other people didn't was they were trying to make the perfect website, the best program, say the right thing, the perfect photos, stuff like that. And we just got out there, talked to people, coached, made mistakes, learned from them, moved on. But the thing was, by the time they were ready to start, they still had all those mistakes to make, but they'd invested all this time and money into it, make a couple of mistakes, then they're out of it. And you're absolutely right. It's about kind of embracing that a mistake should give you more confidence going into the next one, because you're all right, well, this is not what I'm going to do next time. I'm doing the same situation, but with more knowledge, you know, of what doesn't work. And yeah, that's kind of how confidence builds.
Yeah. I think it's a really important part of it. And I think you mentioned there, Richard, about your life as a GP, which is something that if you want to tell us a little bit more about that, because what we're also interested in, the journey that you've been on, because there's been some key decisions there to leave the GP practice, you know, and become a coach. So what drew you to being a GP? And in terms of it, from the outside, many people would think, well, surely you need more confidence doing that than you would standing up on stage. Do you know what I mean? It kind of feels like that until the way you explained, you sort of hinted at it there, the reasons why, but there's confidence in that. You're dealing with people's health and lives and all that kind of thing. Tell us a bit about your background and your journey.
So I chose to go into medicine in a way that not many, like, well, some doctors do, but it wasn't like a calling type thing. Like a lot of people sort of, you know, go into medicine for that reason. Mine was much more kind of like rationally made decisions. So like, I thought, I didn't get much in the way of career guidance, which was awesome. Thanks very much. So it was just a question of like, oh, you know, figure out for yourself what you want to do basically. So what I thought about was like, okay, I'd always had a love of science, like all the way through school, really loved it. It was naturally inquisitive that way, like trying to figure out how the world works and, you know, the way things, why do things work the way they work. I particularly like had a fondness for biology and the human body. So that was that. And then I loved talking to people and I always felt like I liked being helpful in life. So it's just like that. And then a big part of it, to be quite honest, was I came from a working class, not well off background at all. And I was like, I don't want this to be the rest of my life. I want to do better than this. So set my goals high and went, thought, right, doctor, I'll go for it, you know. And it was always like, well, if I don't get it, I'll do like a biochemistry or something of that nature. Because there's always options in medicine that if you can't hit it, you can take like another qualification along the way. But I was like, no, you know, like shoot for the moon kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? That's basically why I did it. And it wasn't like a calling type thing. So maybe, I don't know, in hindsight, maybe that's got something to do with why it wasn't as fulfilling when I actually got to that point. Because it didn't live up to what I thought it might actually be like. You know, there was none of the, I don't know, I think I thought I had the kind of, you know, the romantic notion of living in the countryside with me Labradors and, you know, having all that kind of stuff. Right. And then you kind of get into nitty gritty general facts. You're like, oh my God, this couldn't be further from the truth kind of thing. But it took a long, I ended up in general practice, to be fair, but more by a process of exclusion really than anything else. You know, and now in hindsight, I think to myself, I'm quite aware, and me and Phil talk about this principle of like, you know, it's better to be moving towards something than moving away from something. And I think I was doing a lot of moving away from, because it was kind of like, oh, I don't like the hospital environment, so I don't want to work there. I don't like this, I don't like that. So that basically leaves this. And it did feel appealing in some ways, I'm not going to lie. But at the same time, I think that's how I got there, more than like, oh, I want to be a GP from day one kind of thing. But yeah, that's how I ended up in general practice.
So what, I'm interested in what made you make that big change, because for many people, you know, as a former police officer as well, you know, there are careers that, you know, you're set for life unless you do something stupid or criminal, I guess. And it's very much like, if you don't rock the boat, you may not be getting what you want out of it, but you've got a career, you've got, it's pretty secure and you can sort of coast along kind of thing. To make a change to something less secure, quite scary, I would imagine, you know. What led you to that?
It was always just, because I think there's, so one of the key things for me was I always had a love of technology. And in doing that, I got to know a lot about Steve Jobs and his life, and took a great interest in the things that he had to say and stuff like that. And I watched many moons long time before I left medicine, I watched his Stanford commencement speech, and he was talking about like work is a huge part of your life and you should be fulfilled in what you do, and you know, and then he talked about like death is a great motivator, you're all going to die someday, you know, tick you know, the clock's ticking kind of thing. It's an amazing speech to watch. Like, I don't know if the people who were at Stanford appreciated what they were actually sitting and listening to, but for me, it was an amazing speech. And then I think I just started to internalize some of that and think about how actually I was seeing that all the time in my day-to-day work, like people having their life cut short unexpectedly, tragedy coming on families and stuff like that. You just think, yeah, like how long have you got left? And actually, no, this isn't fulfilling me at all. Like I'm here, I'm doing it, but it was almost like I'd got to the end of the ramp sort of thing. And just went, that was the kind of feeling when I got to the end of it. Like, and even after you know, I did my medical degree, and then you've got obligatory general practice training that everyone has to do as well. And when I went through it at the time, you could just stop then and that was it kind of thing. But I then even went on to do the Royal College exams as well, which is like a further level to prove your ability as a GP. Like I say, it's not essential and it costs you money to do it, but I was like, yeah, okay, I'll give that a go as well, see if I can like get, I got that as well. But then I was like, no, what do I do kind of thing. And then it was just doing the job kind of thing. And just over time, it's like, nah, this doesn't fill up my cup, you know? It's just...
That takes from, I think I've had 2-3 big career changes throughout my career. And it takes some balls to do as well.
Or stupidity.
I think there's a bit of that. I think there's a huge leap of faith there. You talk about confidence, wow, but you've got to be like really confident. And I think once you get to that point, you know, I've been in my career sometimes a little bit stuck and reflect a little bit, you know, work my way up in sales director, working for a large corporate company. And then life changes come along. We're losing my dad. You know, and I think sometimes there's things that do come along in your life where it's just a bit of a light bulb and you go, yeah, I need to change this for me because you're right. You know, we're always looking at, well, I'll do that next year or I'll wait till that happens. Well, do it now. Mm. You know, if you can do something, if it's a small change every day, well, that's a big change.
The thing that always got me around that was like the number of people I'd talk to who had all their plans for retirement.
Yeah.
And you're like, you didn't make it, did you? Yeah. You know, it's just heartbreaking to see.
I had that with my dad. You know, when my dad died, he didn't retire. You know, there was plans in place. But to be fair to my dad, you know, he did live a great life. And I would say that he fulfilled a lot of things, you know, with his family. So yeah. I kind of look at that and think there's a lesson learned there. And I still haven't learned that yet. Mm-hmm. But definitely live for the now.
Yeah. It's interesting that. So what about your story, Phil? Because again, this is the thing that's fascinating, is that we're talking about the things that trigger those changes.
Yeah.
What about you? Because you've got some changes in life.
I suppose. So I worked in finance. It was my first job. I was very young. Like on and off, but for the most part, I worked in finance. And tried to quit in the first week. Hated it. I'm like, no, just stick it out. That's the polite way of putting it. They didn't quite say that. So I worked in it, hated it, but it was that mentality of, yeah, you've got a decent job, just stick with it. And then you stick with it, you're miserable, you retire, you're a bit less miserable, and then you die. And then I've been in for about 17 years. I've done all the jobs and stuff like that. Like, same as you. I had no passion for it, but I'd be like, yeah, I'll go for a promotion. Yeah, why not? Because I'm here, I might as well. And then I was driving back, and my son had just been born, so I was probably tired and delirious. But I was driving back from work, and it's someone, I can't remember who, I can't remember what radio station, but there was this woman on, and she was saying, how can I look at my kids and tell them to follow their passion and their dreams when I go and I work in this, like, I think it was like a supermarket or something like that. But how can I do that when I go there every day and I'm miserable and I come home and tell them how miserable I am? There was something about that just absolutely like like inwardly collapsed, and I just got home and my wife handed over my son, and I was just like, I'm gonna have to sack it in. So I went and I retrained as a psychotherapist, and I went and I did that, a very, very hard right turn. But like it was, I made a list of all the things I actually like about working in the bank versus what I don't. And it's like helping people, listening to people, one-on-one conversation, all that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, they were like, oh, why don't you go into psychotherapy? So I did, trained up in that, did that for a bit. And then I got frustrated with a lot of the mental health systems, especially in the UK,
where they're just like, right, you can see someone before like 4 to 6 to 8 sessions and then you're done. And when realistically, you know, like now as a coach, I get the value of working with someone for 3 months, you know, as a minimum, or doing the longer term work, because I was just like having to, you know, usher people out the door. Like, yeah, I know we've done a bunch of good stuff and we're not quite there, but, you know, time. So, yeah, I moved in. I got one session with a coach and talked with her and it was great. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing this then. And then done that and just, yeah, made the one decision I would tell any up-and-coming coach not to do, which is just sack everything off and go, yeah, I'm just going to do full-time coaching. Do you know what you're doing?
Nah.
But it was that thing of jumping out the plane, but maybe jumping out without checking you've got a parachute. But it was just going for it and betting on myself a little bit. And, it worked out, you know, thank God. But, yeah, it was very much just gone the opposite direction very fast.
Mm.
God bless my family.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because like you talked about it there.
Mm.
I know it sounds like ludicrous doing that and like making that jump, but there was a really good point in rule in Stephen Bartlett's new book, 33 Rules.
Yeah.
And one of the things he says in that is, don't have a plan B. He said, if you want to succeed, you have a plan A and that's it. So, because the fact that you have a plan B distracts you from plan A and makes the chances of you succeeding in plan A even less. I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, but I see where he's coming from with that entirely.
Okay. I got some advice years ago. I went to a HubSpot marketing automation conference and it stuck with me. And this guy was talking about businesses setting up and using their software and everything else. And he said at the time, and this was before I'd even contemplated setting a business up, and he said, you can either dip your toe in or you can dive right in. And that just stuck with me, like about everything in business, in work. And I suppose, you know, if you've got your fingers in many pies, which a lot of people have, but if your main focus and you're deflecting away from that with your plan B, I think I totally agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if I had a backup in mind, as soon as coaching got tough, exactly, and kind of getting through that's allowed me to help other people through that, and there was a lot of value in going through the tougher times in that.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I remember I left the police twice.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think I escaped them twice. I finally escaped them finally a few years back. First time, I left them with no intention of going back, so I didn't have the plan B. But it's a bit like that analogy of I jumped out of the plane, I didn't have a parachute, and I hit the ground. And I remember having to rake around for £2 down the back of my couch to go and pay the Northern Rock to stop my house getting repossessed. And it was a point like that where I thought, right, let's get real. So I then went back to policing because I had no skills and stuff. So I think there's a combination between, you only ever hear, I guess about the people who succeed, but there's also the fact that not having a plan B, still pack a bloody parachute, still try, you know, do the things to prepare yourself for it.
Exactly.
Because if you've got a context like responsibilities, family, you have to factor those things in, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the painful lesson I learned at that particular point. So building it up more sensibly, I would say, worked for me. So you were saying, you know, have a job, have something in backup. I worked for a good number of years part-time, then full-time in the police. Yes, I could have done another jump, but I was burnt by it as well. So I think it's kind of, and that's where confidence took a real nosedive for me, I think, as well. So it's interesting to look at the different journeys and the different takes on it.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a hard right and wrong. I just don't think it's an interesting point to keep in mind of like not that you can't do what you did, but it's just like, but have that awareness that it is taking me away from what I'm doing. Don't kid yourself that it's not going to take you a lot longer to get to where you want to go, because you haven't got that fire under your backside kind of thing, so to speak.
I think I measured success slightly differently as well, that I think a lot of people do, in that for me, when I was coming home from the bank, and to a lesser extent when I was coming home from psychotherapy, I was just the weight of the world was on my shoulders. I was knackered. I didn't want to connect. I didn't want to engage with my family. You know, that's a big reason we started our project. And just the energy I was coming home with, I can only describe it as just, you know, I felt like when my dad used to get home from his job in the factory, I'd be like, I was working, don't talk about it. Okay. And that was me. But once I kind of started my coaching, once I started getting into that, and the, you know, the thing about coaching is it's very like progressive, it's very aspirational, you know, rather than, you know, maybe more the counseling side, which is what, you know, what it is. I could come home with like energy for my kids, and I wanted to talk to my wife, and I wanted to be in life, I suppose. And that's how I measured my success, not like, so when I was starting up the coaching, and maybe the financial side of it wasn't great, I still had that energy and I still had that thing that I was looking for. So I almost didn't need to look at a plan B because I knew going back to where I was not something I was willing to do. Mm. And yeah, I still use that as a measure of success. If I've had a successful day, I come home and I can, you know, be the man I want to be. Mm.
I think that's a really good point to just flag up. Because how many of us judge success by perhaps a salary or a status or something? Mm-hmm. And part of learning, I guess, is to realize, well, actually there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
But tell us a bit, it's probably a good segue into the project then, because the two of you, obviously you're coaching, but you're now working on this project, which is another thing we're fascinated with, because relationships, I mean, come on, that's a massive thing. Tell us about the project and what obviously brought you to it and what you do.
Yeah, do you want me to take that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it started out with, we were chatting about how blokes never have good level three conversations. So level one, strangers on the street, how you doing? How's the weather? Doesn't this bus look rammed? Whatever it is. I think I'm just thinking of meeting people at a bus stop and that. But, there's level two, ones you have with your family and your mates down the pub. How's things? How's the wife? How's the job? Maybe a little bit more, but not much. And then there's the level three, which is the, how are you doing? How's, you know, how are you coping with that tough thing you said at work? Or like having like proper, you know, conversations that notice the person. And that's what it started out as. And we just kept seeing more and more patterns in blokes and their relationship where they were miserable. They were they thought their role as the bloke was to go out and work and work and work and provide. And then they get home and then the wife's really appreciative and the kids are like, yeah, dad. And it just doesn't happen like that because they put so much of themselves into their work that they're not showing up. You know, they're not connected to their wife because all of their energy's over here, or they're not there for their kids because all of their energy's over here, and they get home and they're knackered. And I know I'd experienced that, and I wanted to help blokes connect more. You know, I'm not saying like abandon your work or so there, but there's ways to manage it, isn't there? You can be successful in business, but also get home and be a successful husband and a successful father and be proud of who you are. But that's kind of the origins of it, certainly. And then I roped you in.
Yeah, well, we talked about like how Phil was sort of telling me his thoughts, and I completely related to that because I've seen to him, like when I was working as a GP, I couldn't count the number of times I would see guys come in and just go, like just break down, completely break down. They'd obviously never let go of that with anybody. And all it took was just one or two gentle questions, and then the whole thing just, there's like a stack of cards, the whole thing just collapses. And it was just like these little things, like I said, like some of the messages that I picked up along the way being a GP from what people say, and just hearing guys say things like, I wish I could have told her that, or why didn't I tell her that? Or, but by the time they've had that thought, she's already out the door and gone, you know? And it's just like, we just need to have that conversation earlier on and be willing to be brave again and have the courage to open up like that to a partner. Mm. And we might be able to stop that from happening in the first place.
I think this is huge, and it's one of the reasons why we've ultimately set this podcast up as well, because I completely relate to it with myself with past relationships as well. And it's really known that, but it's who to speak to. You know, I spent 3 years not drinking alcohol, walking every weekend and listening to so many podcasts. I was in all the Stephen Bartlett's. within a couple of months, you know, and it's, so there's really some self-help there, but that's hard. You've then got to realize that you need help, and then you're the person that can help yourself. Others can help, but you also, you ultimately need to work on yourself. And I think men struggle like hell to have this conversation, no matter whether it's with family, because they don't want to put on them, if it's the mates, because they don't really want to have that conversation, because they're all manly and we go to the pub and we don't talk about things like that. And I think it is. I think it's definitely worse than ever. You know, my circle of friends, I see that. And certainly I get it with the three levels of conversation. Yeah. You know, I've got friends and I've been guilty of just level one and level two only and really, and not listening either. You know, because I think men like to talk, but then not listen as well.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, if you are struggling a little bit, you spoke to your mate, but he's just spoke at you rather than listening, and you walk off and you're in the same boat.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking in the group the other night and I was saying how often I would get back from like a couple of hours with my best mate and my wife would be like, how's his wife? I don't know. How's his job going? I don't know. So what did you talk about for like 3 hours?
What were we actually talking about?
But like when I reflect back on it, like I've completely missed the person, you know, the person I was there with and you know, I was just having this
general
banter, and which the I think a big misconception is there's always a place for that, and there's a place for you know your stereotypical bloke banter, stoicism, all that kind of stuff, but it's about having more tools in your toolbox. It's about being able to connect when you need to. It's about being able to express your emotion when you need to, and then you're not feeling like you're completely isolated. Like how many times in our group sessions has someone brought something up and everyone's like, I get that. I relate to that. I thought I was the only person, but it's this big universal feeling with blokes, isn't there? Around a lot of things.
Somebody could come in and, you know, they don't think they've had much to talk about in a group session. Yeah. And before we know it, half the session's gone and they're still talking, you know, and it's like, and we don't interrupt because it's so valuable what they're saying. Even if sometimes if guys don't think that it's directly relatable to them, they'll always find something that comes out of that discussion for them as well. So
well, it's amazing how many times we've got thought, well, or maybe we've got feelings, but we don't have the words for them. And someone in the group will just say something and it just hits you like that. And you're like, that's exactly it. That's exactly what I've been feeling. That's exactly what I've been trying to figure out. And that's why we'll find the group sessions work so well, is because everyone's in a really similar boat. And like, yeah, you can't really go and talk to your mates because it stops at level two. And you can't really approach your wife or your partner with it because on paper, you've got this ideal life. So blokes tend to just scuttle off, pretend everything's all right, start sedating themselves with, you know, women, drink, drugs, all of that kind of good stuff. And taking themselves away from it. And what we're trying to do is create more of a community around it. So when those things come up, you've got a place to go, you've got a place to talk with people who understand, because like marriage counseling and therapists, sometimes they're just, especially if I'm not trying to like, I'm overgeneralizing here, but sometimes when a bloke's put in front of a female therapist, there's a limit to how much you think she can get the experience of it, because it is different being a bloke, you know, better and worse. There is a different thing. And I think there's a lot more people relating to experiences within the group.
Do you not think in terms of, because I've certainly got experience of that myself. And like I thought the only way to change this for me personally and to be a better person around other people, including relationships going forward, family, friends, partners, I have to do the work on myself first rather than somebody. I think it's very easy to blame others around you. You know, there's always some, you know, excuse that it's somebody else is making you feel like that. Well, hang on a minute. You know, it was a bit of a light bulb moment for me, you know, when I quit alcohol, and I was like, there's only me that can change this. I need to become a better person. And that's still ongoing now. This isn't just like, I suppose you go back to your eight sessions. God, it's not going to take it. This is like every day.
Absolutely.
That you've got to work at this. But it's for guys, it's like, how do you start that? How do you realise that? You know, you're blaming other people. Well, actually, you put the work in yourself.
Yeah. I mean, we do an entire session on taking ownership and not looking outside of yourself, because it is so easy to be like, oh, you know, my wife's done this, or my mate has done that. And it's never, okay, well, how am I responding to it? How am I relating to it? You know, relationships, not really two people. It's how you're relating to someone else, how you're, you know, that's why I've got a relationship with work, relationship with money, relationship. It's how you, the individual, are relating and responding to whatever's in front of you. And that's why a lot of my work is to do with the individual and focused on the individual and how they are in the relationship, as opposed to, right, well, let's get you both in and you know, like couples counseling sometimes is, which is, it's got its place. I'm just saying it doesn't work for everyone, in my experience anyway.
I'm just sort of thinking now, one of the things that I've done a bit of reading in my time over this is that there's almost like a code for blokes. And it starts on when you're a boy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Policing each other's how we show up. So it's very deep rooted. If there's a listener out there who's kind of thinking, makes sense, but where do I start? What would you say to them to sort of help them over that first hurdle or hump to making the changes?
Do you want me to take it?
Well, can you define that a bit more? Where did they start with what?
So it's like making the first. So if I look at my experience, you know, my relationship wasn't in a good place. I was spending a lot of time at work, pretty much all the scenarios that we've just talked about before. Mm. And it's like for guys, if I go back then, sort of what, four and a half years ago, like if I was coming along and saying, this is where I'm at work all the time, my relationship's suffering, I'm making wrong life decisions, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Where do I start? Mm-hmm. You know, at the time I thought, right, I need to make this change now. Luckily for me, I could make those changes, mm-hmm. but I started to listen to other people. Yeah. So listen to podcasts rather than speak directly to somebody, mm-hmm. which probably would have helped us massively. So it's really, what would you advise for that, for a guy like me in that position? What would be the first step for me to start making those changes?
Yeah, I would say look at, yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously I'm biased and I would say our group, but find a group. And the reason I would say group individuals, yeah, that would also work as well. But I think having that knowledge that there's other people around you going through a similar thing, trying to get at the same thing. And there are lots of groups out there. But just finding the one that suits you, the one that you think you would feel most comfortable in, and going down that route, I would personally say is the best.
Yeah, I mean, I would add to that, like, there's limits to there's a few things to be aware of when it comes to like the self-help. Is first of all, you're going to get a multitude of conflicting bits of advice, which is going to leave you in the tailspin more than likely, yeah. if you listen to it too much. A lot of people just listen and don't act on any of it, and that's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, if you listen and you act, if you come away from, you know, if you listen to a podcast, listen to this podcast even, just, you know, at the end of it, think, right, what's one thing I can actually do?
Yeah.
Do, mm-hmm. not to think about, do off the back of this. Mm-hmm. And then you'll actually start making some changes in your life then. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're only thinking about it, nothing's going to move forward.
The term I've heard is educational masturbation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just listening to the podcast, being like, this is great. And then you just do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that was something that I was really conscious of. Mm-hmm. I was like, I have to make some actions here.
Yeah.
And I think, fortunately for myself, I was thinking, I think I'm intelligent enough to pick the bones out of certain things. Mm-hmm. But if I look back, being in a group, you know, like I also felt, which I would suspect a lot of guys do, is quite lonely. Even if you've got friends around you and you've got family around you. I was looking around me thinking, I've got so many people around me, and I felt extremely lonely.
Yeah.
And I wished back then, I think if I look at it and I had my time again, I wished I'd have gone to some kind of group. Because I would have sat around other guys who were experiencing exactly the same as me. Mm-hmm. Here's me thinking, I'm the only one that's got problems here. That's not the case, is it?
No, absolutely. Unfortunately, blokes will tend to only try and work on it when it's broken, mm-hmm. you know, until there's the doomsday event, until you know, you come home and you find the note left on the kitchen thing that the wife's gone. And we've worked with some like really successful people who are incredibly lonely, because on paper your life looks great. And so who do you turn to and say, actually, no, I'm really unhappy here. You know, I've got this really great business, but I feel empty from it. And I've got this beautiful wife and I don't connect to her at all. And, you know, you can't really admit that to mates, family, your wife, because you're admitting, oh, there's a problem here and I don't know what it is. And but then they'll turn around and go, oh, you've got all this stuff, shouldn't you be happy? And be like, well, no, not really.
The other benefit of, you know, moving away from, I'm not saying that self-help doesn't have a valuable role to play. I think it can, but the beauty of working with somebody else is they will often pick up on a blind spot that you have, that you just, and that's the trouble with a blind spot. You're never going to know what's there. You're never going to be able to see it. It's going to constantly be out of your field of view. So working with somebody else can shine a light on something where you go, oh my God, I hadn't even considered that. And sometimes even within the group, the guys can create that for the other person as well, because they'll hear another guy say, like, oh, I did this and that, and think, oh my God, I do that. Yeah. Like, you know, but they've never considered it.
Absolutely going to pick up on that, and it's only because somebody around me in the last 12 months, and I thought I was a really good listener, and you know, I've done a lot of work on myself, and I realised that I didn't probably, we're not getting to level three enough. I don't think I listened enough. And what I try and do now, and again, that's some work, is sit back a little bit, really absorb what somebody's saying, you know, rather than being on to the next thing, you know, and then you just don't, you're not a good friend, you're not a good partner, you're not a good husband, you're not a good whatever. Because I think we're already on to the next thing, and that's not really helping the fact that you're not listening to who's around you.
Absolutely.
And having that quality time observing like what goes on day to day.
You want to go?
I was going to say, well, why do you think, I would say the thing there is why are men not listening? And the answer is often because we're listening for the problem to fix.
That's what I was going
to
say.
Our brain is engaged in that, but we're listening for it. We're like, where's the problem? What's the bit I can solve for it? We're not actually just listening to what's happening, and especially within relationships.
Oh yeah, massively.
We're doing that. You know,
I love that, because it's like, I was thinking about this this morning, and naturally people want to fix people. And rather than fixing themselves and working on themselves, they're putting all this time into fixing other people. And if we could just fix ourselves and really work on ourselves, I get that completely of listening how we can fix other people, not what's actually being said.
Yeah, I think as blokes, especially when I mean, there's that universal feeling of when a lady might have come up to you and told you a problem and you offer a solution, and then you get your head bitten off. You're like, I don't know what's happened there. And we always look at exactly what you say, how to fix the problem, instead of putting yourself in the other person's shoes and really trying to understand. Like if you're trying to fix a problem, what you're essentially saying is, I don't think you can fix the problem, here's an actual solution to the problem, when really the wife or the other person only just wants you to listen and understand and be like, this is how it is for me. And if you get, you know, we work on guys with that, and if you can kind of understand how the other person is feeling without necessarily always trying to fix it, the connection grows, and they know how to fix problems. Not unless they actually say, how do I fix this problem? Don't jump in and don't fix it. That's always a massive part of it.
I think that's one of the key things that always comes out through our work is, like, have you asked the question? Like, you know, you're telling me all this stuff, have you asked her? And it's just amazing how many times people say, well, no.
Kind of.
And it's like, or kind of, well, she would normally think this. And like, but on this specific thing, have you asked her directly, what does she think about X, Y, and Z? Well, no. Off you go then. You know, it's like, it's just amazing. It's like, that's the bit that's often just missing. Have the conversation.
And it's a powerful thing, the mind, in many ways, in good and bad ways. But, you know, if you're starting to think what the other person's thinking without actually engaging with them and speaking to them, your mind's just off on one.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, it snowballs from there.
Yeah. I would always say a good way to pick up on that is if someone's talking to you and you're already thinking of the next thing you're going to say or what the response is or what the answer's going to be, then you're not probably listening. Because what's actually going on, you're going to record, this is going to, how I'm going to show my worth to someone else. I'm going to prove I'm valuable. So
I'm ready for this.
Yeah. But when you can work on yourself, when you can be comfortable with yourself and you know that your value is just being there and connecting and you don't necessarily have to come up with the answer, it's very freeing and you get a bit more confidence.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Guys, we could probably go, this is probably a part 2, 3, 4, and 5 actually. Yeah. Conscious of time, and thanks very much for sharing everything. And I think there's a lot of takeaways there. What one of the things that we do like to do just to sort of wrap up the podcast is ask everybody, every guest, is there an object or something from your past that is particular, object could be clothing, accessory, anything, that brings a bit of a smile to your face or a bit of a positive memory or something back to you. And so I don't know who wants to go first, putting you on the spot.
Whatever.
I'll go.
Yeah.
I couldn't bring it because it's, because it's too big and I don't have it anymore.
Is it a timer? No.
Imagine if it just came through the studio. No. It would be my first ever hi-fi for me. Just the amount of fun that I got out of having that. And like as a young lad, having something that was mine for my music to play loud, you know, and just dance around the room like a nut and sing. And, you know, I loved that thing so much. And again, you know, I don't want tears and sympathy, but I didn't come from a well-off background. So it was a big thing to get a half decent hi-fi for me as a kid. And I boy, did I treasure and look after that thing. So many hours.
Did it have a CD player as well?
What?
CD player?
It did. And I remember my first CD that I got from it as well. So yeah, it was Prince's Love Symbol album.
Fantastic.
So, and it sounded amazing. Yeah. Nice.
Love it.
For me, again, I didn't bring it because, you'll find out why. So it was my first ever guitar. The first instrument I ever learned was the violin, and I don't know if you know about the violin, but it's not a cool instrument. There's not like a big flock of ladies going towards violinists. So I was like, right, I'm going to pick something cool. I like the guitar. Great. I want to learn guitar. And my mum bought us my first guitar. It was just a cheap Fender Squire. And it was Prince-esque purple glitter. Sweet. Guitar. Well, it would, but like I was in a punk band and I was like so it's, but that guitar, like it was so freeing and so mine. I've been struggling for that individualism and this was mine. I could go off and I could learn it, I could write and I could create. And that was really the start of my being in love with anything creative. And I love to write and I love to make new sounds and stuff like that. And it was like the worst guitar, but it was great. I love it. It's covered in stickers and smashed up now. but I love it. It's like this big, big cave of memories for us of all the gigs I did and stupid things I did. And
I think that's phenomenal because if we go back as well, I don't think we have enough alone time.
And I
think with a guitar and even a hi-fi, you know, music's very different now because it's obviously on our phones.
Sure.
So we combine Spotify with what's on our phones and we're on apps. But a guitar, you're in your own space without anything else, and that's like so important now to have something where you can just switch off from electronic devices as well.
Well, that's so, it, and it's connecting to yourself and being able to, or I can get an expression across in this, or I can put words together for this and stuff like that. It's the best.
I think this is one of the reasons why we want to ask the question, because it might seem a bit random, but it's also putting back to, that's from the past. How much are we doing this for ourselves now? Because you can lose yourself as you get through life. You get your responsibilities, your demands, all of this. And part of, I guess, rekindling relationships is your relationship with yourself, the space you have with yourself. And what objects do we have now or to create that space that in 10 years time we're going to look back with a similar kind of nostalgia? So I think it's a really interesting question. that is relevant now, you know?
Yeah, of course. Brilliant. It's really beautiful that you say that, because it's just made me think, like, within the last couple of months, one of the things that I did was went up in the attic and got all my CDs back out. And I've got quite a nice home hi-fi setup now. It was one of the first things I bought when I qualified as a doctor, was a really nice CD player and speakers and stuff like that. And yeah, I've got my old CDs back out, so now I can just enjoy the experience of just sitting and listening to the music again.
Yeah. Brilliant.
My first CD was Shania Twain.
Oh man.
You do realise you've said that over podcast.
Yeah, I want that on record.
I think mine was Deacon Blue, to be fair.
It's been nice working with you, Phil, anyway.
No, it was a Shania Twain Christmas with the Smurfs doubleheader.
That's just snowballed into something else.
Can I date myself and say my first thing was a tape of compilation Axe Attack? It had Black Sabbath on, it had AC/DC and all that. But I kind of feel like I'm dating myself, because I was going to ask you, did it have a turntable, not a CD player?
Oh, it had a turntable and a CD player.
Yeah. Class.
So I remember my first tape, because I'm 50, Five Star. I don't know what happened, because I was really pop music, and then I went to metal, and it just kind of like eclectic taste in music.
I remember my first tape was... Daydream Believer, the Peter Reed version.
Right.
Love it. That'll appeal to all Sunderland fans, including myself.
Lads, it's been excellent. It's been a great conversation. Really enjoyed it. I think there's loads of value there. Just as parting, if anybody wants to follow up, there will be your contact information in show notes, but is there a shout out to where they can get in touch with you?
If you go to www.thebettermanproject.co.uk, all our stuff's on there. You can contact us through there. We're on LinkedIn and Facebook and stuff like that if you search for our names, but Batman Project everywhere.
Yep.
Awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Brilliant. Cheers. Loved it.
Cheers.
I hope that you enjoyed the episodes and got something from that. If you did, we would love you to share our podcast.
And if you're not already, subscribe to the show and leave us a rating and a review. That really helps spread the word.
I'd also like to thank our podcast producer, Bernardo, for doing a sensational job.
And thanks to the awesome Logan Nicholson of musicformakers.com for the music for the podcast. Catch you in the next episode.
Thanks, guys.